And so that's in a sense my key point of departure. I want to tell you a story, though. I have had the experience before of dealing with classes in which there is sort of a sweep of energy along some direction, and people worry, are they being swept up against their will? At one point, I took it to an extreme. I was teaching first-year torts, and at one point, I suggested that we all stand up on our desks just to break through the architectural boundary of the classroom a little bit. And it was a classroom very much like this. Everyone stood up in the room except two. There was a guy over here who didn't stand up. And there was a young woman over here who didn't stand up. And I asked the guy, I said, how come you didn't stand up? And he looked me right in the eye and he said, because I didn't want to. And I asked the young woman, why didn't you stand up? And she said, to protect you from the accusation that we had no choice. I thought that was wonderful. I thought that was actually profound. So it's in that mode that you have to deal with my enthusiasms. All right, learning from scratch. Another of the fears in the memos was of what is this scratch thing that we're about to get into, or do I actually have to do programming? And some actually numerous fears about the technical aspects. Well, I have to say, let me just get out of this in order to say it. I have to say, you definitely overcame your fears. Have you all visited the Scratch Gallery in our wiki? It's absolutely wonderful. I spent a fair amount of the morning poking around our Scratch Gallery. And that leads me to our list. Now, we can't do all of them, but would anyone like to come down and just demonstrate their game? Someone who's proud of what you did. Come on down. Come on. You're fidgeting. Come on down. Is that yours? Which one is yours?
It's called Pentagon.
Which one?
Pentagon.
Pentagons. Did I not see pentagons? I don't think I've opened pentagons. Is that in our gallery? Forgive me. How did I miss it? No, that's not what I'm wanting. So where is Pentagons?
Third from the bottom.
Third from the bottom. So I have to save it down to my machine, which turns out to be just wonderfully easy to do. Download it. And then open it in Scratch.
Professor, I think you still have to extract it.
Oh, yes, yes, you're absolutely right. Excuse me, you're totally right. Oh, dear. Where am I? I'm here.
You'll have to explain to me because I have a great job. I could have made my life so barely a web page. So I did not find anything about it. I had to be sitting at the icon. It's a typical water fountain. It doesn't look like it's for a while. It's for old. It's very shiny. No.
So now, come on up here. So now, what do you say? Was programming these things fun or not? Was it all right? It was pretty good, right? All right, come on up here.
Sure. Okay. I have to click the flag, though.
Oh, they have to click
the flag. There's a little green button in the upper corner.
Right there.
Yeah.
Right up there.
That's the flag.
In the upper
oh,
corner.
I see.
Bang. Welcome. According, whoops, going by too fast.
There's no sound
though. Should there be sound?
Yeah, there should be.
Oh. I wonder why there's no sound. Go ahead, try it again. I wonder why we're not getting sound. We should be getting sound here. Do we want to have some technical pause here where we see why we're not getting sound? Beck, can you see if you can figure out? Why aren't we getting sound?
I don't think that's a good thing to try to figure out right at the moment.
Okay.
Maybe.
All right.
What tier should I go into next? I don't know if this is winner or loser.
Go to three.
And I'll win it this time, so.
Well done. Who is this handsome fellow?
That's Kevin Parker.
Right there. That's right. That's this guy right here. That's what you get for sitting next to this.
Serious.
All right. Well, many, many wonderful games that you have all produced. And really, it's just fun to spend your time going through them.
Can we see one more?
Can we see one more? Do we have one more volunteer?
Or just pick one out of your list.
Let's see.
Siddhartha, I want to see that.
Yeah, I want to see that one.
I couldn't get Siddhartha to run just right for me. Oh, I remember Mary's Lamb. That was cute. Oh, how about this one? This one's just simple and really sweet. Did I miss something? Here, I'm going to do one more. Might do a number more, actually. This is something in the same vein, but also lovely. I wish, but we need the sound. How is it that I don't have sound?
Oh, because you have it plugged into that thing.
Little lamb, where are you? We're going to be late for school.
Clear cutting,
Grace. Then we had some like serious games in here. I mean, the ones you need multiplayers for. Let's see. There was one that was, this one is fierce. Whose game is this? Come on down. Come on then. You got to play this geek. Let's get what you need. Do I have an extra what?
No.
Oh, wait a minute. No. No.
This is what happens when you give scratch to a real programmer.
Yeah. Who else wants to play? Let's get two players.
Two players. Get some down here. There we go. God, tell us about this.
All right. So basically, the idea is that the dots are all trapped in this maze, and the jailer is controlling the mouse. And by clicking on different patches of the maze, he can trap it for a brief time. And if the dot travels onto the trapped patch, then the dot will die. And so there are always four dots, and you can have 1 to 3 dot players trying to escape, and then the rest are decoys, so the jailer doesn't know which is which. My mouse doesn't... Oh, there it goes. Okay. So you're going to be player one, I guess.
Okay.
So you'll use A and D to turn left and right.
And what am I trying to do?
You're trying to get to the helicopter.
I gotcha.
It's exactly the size of one dot, so whoever gets there first gets out.
Left and right, how do I go up and down?
So it'll keep moving in the direction it's going, and you turn it left and right, and it'll keep moving.
I see.
So you, player two, use B and M.
Come on over here, BM.
Just watch on the screen here. Okay.
Which dot am I?
You'll get to choose. Yours will start talking.
Well, towards dot.
All right. I'm not looking.
Place one thing. Press and hold space to lock your color.
All right. Now hit enter for the second player. Now press and hold space when it's the color that you want. Press and hold it. Okay. Oh, and I'm not looking. All right. How are we doing? Oh, do we have sound?
Okay. We seem, yes.
All right. So you were trying to get to this helicopter up here. Are you stuck or something? Anyway, I'm going to trap this patch and kill the green one. Wahaha. Unless it gets away. All right. So I have to click and keep the mouse there for 2 seconds, and then it'll turn red and deadly. And then after a little bit, it'll... Oh, no. Let's kill these guys over here.
I'm thinking of that guy. I'm not.
Yeah, that's part of the challenge, actually. Oh, no, someone's getting the helicopter.
Oh, no, I don't know how to turn left.
B&M. Wow, one of these decoys... This one's probably a decoy. Pull that one off. See, and now it's pale, so I can't trap it until it turns. Oh, only 10 seconds left. Got to get to the helicopter. Oh.
So this is a serious game.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
All right, so many games here. I want to address the fear of incoherence, which was expressed. Now, what
was
do I mean
it
by
that? For scratch?
Nope.
Okay.
It's close. What I mean by incoherence, what you meant by incoherence as I read your feedback memos, was... a worry about, well, what is this class about? What is the point? What is the coherence to what we're doing? We're doing a lot of different things. Specifically expressed in relationship to the scratch programming. Why are we doing this? Well, for that purpose, I actually want to go back to scratch for a moment and show you the one that I've been working on, which is not great, but it's here. Let's see if I can find it. Here's mine. See. Once upon a time, three young people sat around waiting for the law lord to remove their blindfolds. Understand the logic of the game from scratch. That's the idea. We're building up from the bottom. And the core idea that I want you to get and to work from is the power of changing point of view. It is the basic lawyer skill. It's the core of what I want to relate to you today in the form of a look at empathic argument. So here you are. You're sitting at the table. You see these other two young ladies opposing you, each with a red hat, and you can't figure out what hat is on your own head. A hint. You ask yourself a question. Suppose the hat on my head is white. Now you're looking at two red hats. The hands haven't changed. Each sees at least one. And you're stuck until you realize that you can change your point of view and see what it would look like from Becca's point of view. Now, what's Becca looking at? She's looking at this guy with hand up because he sees that red one, but sees Lila with hand up, and where's the red hat that Lila is looking at? Becca would quickly see it must be on her head. But now remember, we're in a changed view situation. It's us over here that has the question. We know it's red on Becca's head. What we don't know is what's on our own head. If it was white on our head, this is the way it would look to Becca. And Becca would figure it out. But Becca isn't figuring it out. And so it can't be a white one on my head. All right, so that was mine. Now I want to show you a version that Rebecca did and that I have slightly modified. Is that the one? No, wait a second, I'm wrong. Excuse me, this is the one. This is Becca. My daughter wishes to marry the smartest man in the kingdom. I found the three smartest men. Now the smartest must solve the riddle of the three hats. I will place a red or white hat on each man's head. No man can see his own hat. Each man must raise his hand if he sees at least one red hat. The first to know the color of his hat wins her hand. And here you are in a much nicer array of the three points of view. We wonder what color is on our own head. We change the point of view. We imagine this other person wondering what color is on their head. We can easily see the problem is totally soluble if there's a white head in the hat in the picture. And when we go back, we recognize, nope, nobody's solving it, so it can't be a white hat in the picture. I must be wearing a red hat. Okay, so to me, that's the core of coherence. We're talking about programming in Scratch, and we're working up both in logic and in code. We're not going to go much further with code, although I'm clear that we could do some really fun things with it, except to keep an understanding eye on the fact that this world we're describing and coming to inhabit is built with code. We see how it's built. It's built with these logic steps, very simply put together, like the way the peanut butter and jelly sandwich is built. And these constraints, then, on how the code works become the external constraints of the architecture within which we're moving. That's a profound idea. That was at the core of Lessig's first seminal book on code as law. It's the essence of an understanding that engineers have that lawyers often don't. When we first started the Berkman Center, Nicholas Negroponte said to me, actually it was before we started it, he said, in cyberspace, law will be as important as engineering. That is, this is an environment that's built of both code and understandings about how people will relate that are made by people with choices to relate to code or not as they choose. All right, so I'd like you to just have faith on the coherent side. What we're looking at is not a fixed object. I'd much rather have you conceive it as a point that is expanding into a cone, almost like the space-time cone as you go forward. We're starting with very simple ideas. This idea of the table and the three hats and the idea of the human ability to draw an inference coming back from an imagined change in point of view, I'm asserting is fundamental, and that's what I'm most interested in pursuing with you today. All right, so that's Scratch. Here, you do it, sweetheart.
Sure. I think I can do that on your computer. How do I get out of here? On the Scratch page on the wiki, you'll notice up in the contents that there are a few different sections. For those of you who haven't yet finished your Scratch programs, we're hoping that you'll do them by the beginning of class tomorrow, so don't worry that you've somehow missed the end of the Scratch cycle. And if you've done them and you haven't uploaded, we have a how to upload section that will help you do it. For everybody who does a Scratch project, at the bottom of the page, there's a place to write what I'm calling a Scratch journal or a Scratch feedback memo. The importance of it is, the name isn't important, except that this is meant to be very different from the feedback memos that you normally do. This is really a technical feedback memo that talks about your experience with the technology and what it was like to try to use this technology. And we don't care so much whether it's anonymous or not from our perspective, but we do need to know that you did it in order to check you off for having done the assignment. And we're asking you just to put it right up here on this wiki page. It's fairly open-ended, just whatever feedback you have for us and also for the designers of Scratch on what it was like to try to learn to use this. It's very interesting for them to have some adults learn to program using this program. I think they initially designed it with children in mind and have since discovered that this might be the best way for everybody to learn to program because it's just so much more fun and easy to get into than the regular ways of learning to program. So whatever kind of feedback you have, please contribute it here. That's all.
All right, now I'd like to get to the main element that I want to focus on today. I call it empathic advocacy. It's to be contrasted with what I think of as oppositional advocacy. I don't know how many of you were interested in Chavez's speech at the UN coming at Bush. I don't know how many of you then followed up and read one or more of the accounts of Alan Dershowitz commenting on Chomsky. I recommend this to you as an example of oppositional argument. Bush, Chavez, Chomsky, Dershowitz. Just take a look at them. What is empathic argument? Well, empathic argument starts with the idea of interpretive stance. It starts with this inference process of forming your identity and your sense of how the world works by putting out stimuli and processing response, with the response being processed against the accumulated, integrated, previously integrated response from just that process. So a recursive process of sending out stimuli, processing back against the grid of your response. If you see that process starting and moving along, and you then see it in the dynamic that Daniel Gilbert describes in the piece that I asked you to look at and will describe to you here again in the New York Times, dealing with who throws the first stone, you build up a sense, a picture of what a dispute consists in. Gilbert's a psychologist. He explores the situation that he epitomized by recalling traveling in the back seat of a car with his parents and his brother, and he and his brother getting into fights, and the fight almost always rising to the point where parents had to intrude. And the two sides of the fights would be, he hit me. And the other side would be, he hit me first. And then the first side would be, but he hit me harder. And Gilbert looks at this as a phenomenon and interprets it in a way that suggests, go forward for just a moment, suggests that the way human beings work is that we're much more aware of what we say and what provoked it than we are the other way around. So he does experiments. He recounts them. Experiments in which two people go back and forth in conversation. And then asking each of those people afterward, do you remember what you said? People almost always remember what they said. Do you remember what provoked you to say it? People almost always remember what provoked them to say it. Do you remember what came next? What was said in response to you? Not so good. People focus on their provocations. They remember what they say. The rest is a little bit less clear. And so he engages in another experiment, describes another experiment, in which, trying to deal with the worry of escalating dispute, he sets up an environment in which two people are given instruction to respond with exactly equal response to what's stimulating you. So they set it up with a little thing where you give a little shock, and you're supposed to give back another little shock. And if everybody just stayed with the little shocks, life would be great, kind of like stimulating the muscles. But he finds that what happens is that each person tends to underestimate the force of the shock that they're giving and overestimate the force of the shock that's come into them. And so he posits a proposition. Research teaches us that our reasons and our pains are more palpable, more obvious and real than are the reasons and pains of others. This leads to the escalation of mutual harm, to the illusion that others are solely responsible for it, and to the belief that our actions are justifiable responses to theirs. All right, so you see a structure in which each individual is perceiving the environment consisting of provocations and interpreting those provocations against a grid that is a different grid than that which is the environment of the person doing the provoking. And a mindset builds up, an interpretive stance, a point of view on the world, a set of beliefs about the reality and how it works around you that is different from the person with whom you have a dispute. And at that point, the phenomenon of cognitive dissonance sets in. When you hear some new input, you will interpret it to be consistent with your structure. There is excellent psychological evidence to the effect that when we take in a stimulus of some kind, we actually process it in different ways. We have a kind of a base brain that goes back to our reptilian origins, the amygdala, the source of emotion, the fear or fight, the quick, instantaneous reaction. And we have a cognitive response generated by the higher cortex where we process it and rationalize it. But the interesting thing is, when they track the path of the incoming stimuli, it comes in, goes to the amygdala, heads to the upper brain, and the feeling that you've already generated comes in at the same time as the stimulus to the upper brain, which suggests a thing I believe to be true. Our brain functions to rationalize our feelings. Feeling comes first. When you experience a stimulus, you immediately have a sense. Is this offense or is it defense? Is this plus, is this minus? If you don't like it, your brain will rationalize it consistent with the structure that you've been in. So you take that Necker cube and you recognize it as having two views. If you look at it, you'll see there is a third view of the Necker cube that's possible. Here it is. Why do I say three views? Well, if you close one eye and look at this, you can see the Necker cube as a three-dimensional object just like that one that you imagined being up on the screen. I invite you up after class to just play with it. But when you put it down, you see that, in fact, it's two opposing mountains, each with a peak. And at the top of each one of those mountains are the disputants. The name of the game in empathic advocacy is to change your point of view. See if you can see the dispute from the other side. Now, I want to do a couple of examples for you. Well, actually, probably only one. All right. Let me just introduce this a bit. How many of you have seen the Rodney King video in the course of your upbringing? The beating by the Los Angeles police, brutally beating Rodney King. Well, this is a tough one to look at. It's a tough one to look at because I'm going to be asking you to see it differently, to see it from the police point of view. We might do the same thing if we worked at it with O.J. Simpson. Can we see the O.J. Simpson case from both points of view, or is one of them just completely missing it? And we might do that with many, many others. But to actually do it, to experience it, is important in getting the idea. Why? Because it brings home to you a core point. An interpretive stance is an emotional point of view. If you're going to persuade someone, you need to move their interpretive stance to a new point. That means moving them emotionally. That means reaching them emotionally. And you can't do it unless you have convinced them that you understand what the world looks like from their particular peak on the top of the Necker cube. So, Tim, you need to take a break. Let's do it right now, then we'll do Rodney. Now, I don't know, you don't really get the screen, do you?
Okay.
All right, so what I'm going to show you is drawn from a production by Court TV that covered the Rodney King trial. They boiled it down to a very nice documentary, which I thought I had queued up, but I'm now having trouble getting to come up on the screen. Why is that? Input 3.
Something happened.
Is coming. Here we go. Okay. Hang on. I can't do this without sound. Oh, I know what the problem is. I know what the problem is. Why do I not have sound?
Did you have sound before?
Huh?
You had the sound before?
I had sound before, yeah. Here we go.
Los Angeles
All right.
Police officers charged.
Pardon me. Let me just go back here for a minute. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through this Court TV story and take it slow at points where it really is telling you the story. And I'm going to speed up and give you a kind of a voiceover with respect to other parts of it.
And in some cases, revenge. A trial that seemed to be based on an 81-second videotape recorded on March 3rd, 1991 on a home video camera. Evidence that seemed so clear and convincing that the nation had already presumed guilt long before the jury reached its verdict.
All right, let's have quiet in the courtroom, please.
But the case wasn't decided in the streets. It was decided in this courtroom. The case is California versus Powell, Wynn, Briceño, and Kuhn. Four Los Angeles police officers charged in the beating of motorist Rodney King. And despite the apparent simplicity of that one piece of videotape evidence, what happened here was anything but simple.
Careful. characters.
In the next 2 hours, you'll have a chance to take a careful look at this case, to judge for yourself what happened that night, to judge whether any of the four defendants broke the law by beating Rodney King excessively and brutally. And after listening to testimony, as the jurors heard it in the courtroom, and to the instructions the judge gave the jury, you can judge for yourself how the jury reached its verdict. All four of the police officers charged are tried together. Officer Lawrence Powell, a 4-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. Powell is seen on the video striking Rodney King over 45 times. He's charged with assault with a deadly weapon, excessive force by an officer, and with filing a false police report. Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, a 14-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. Kuhn faces the most charges, assault with a deadly weapon, excessive force by an officer, filing a false police report, and trying to conceal the alleged crime. While Kuhn did not strike Rodney King with a baton, as the highest-ranking officer on the scene, prosecutors allege that he directed his officers to do so. Officer Timothy Wynn, a rookie on the Los Angeles Police Department. Wynn is seen on the video kicking and hitting King about 15 times, although the exact number is unclear. He is charged with assault with a deadly weapon and with excessive force by an officer. Finally, Officer Theodore Briseño, a 9-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. Briseño is charged with assault with a deadly weapon and with excessive force by an officer. Prosecutors claim that Briseño kicked Rodney King. And it's the tape that prosecutors will use as the linchpin of their case.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Just to reintroduce myself, my name is Terry White. I'm the Deputy District Attorney for Los Angeles County.
All right, so he's the DA. He makes an opening statement in which he describes a high-speed chase through the Los Angeles night in which they eventually wind up stopping Rodney King, and he's with another person in the car, I'll let the story go forward.
Prosecutor Terry White isn't taking anything for granted, despite that powerful piece of evidence against the four officers, the videotape. But if public reaction is any indication, he should be confident. Both President Bush and the mayor of Los Angeles condemn the violence seen on the tape. As his first witness, the prosecution calls the man who videotaped the beating.
So my name is George William Holliday.
Without George Holliday, these four officers might not be on trial. Holliday says he was awakened by police sirens and helicopters, and he took out his new video camera to shoot the event. The full videotape, not just the short snippets aired on the news, is played in court. Parts of it, such as when King rushes at the officers, are blurred.
Holliday was up in his apartment with a new camera, and he shot this out his window, and this
broke on the country like just an amazing new thing, that we were going to be seeing more and more citizen generating evidence in a form such as we have here. All right, the prosecution goes forward, and they call as an early witness the guy he's in the car with. The last minute of the video doesn't have a whole lot. There's King over on the side. We can see it again. He winds up being hogtied. They call this guy. Oh, I gotta watch out. I can't mess with the sound here. Why is that? Mike News.
On the evening of March 2nd, 1991, did you and Mr. King get together?
Say March 91?
Yes.
March 3rd, 91, yeah.
Allen's testimony seems questionable in some respects, and he can't testify about the beating. He was on the ground, hands cupped behind his back, when King was beaten. On cross-examination, Allen is questioned about King's unusual behavior during the chase.
So you told Mr. King to pull over, and he didn't when you said it the first time, did he?
Right.
You thought he might have been in shock, didn't you?
Yeah.
What did you mean by shock?
But he wasn't doing it. He just got stuck to the, whatever he was doing.
Well, you thought he was acting pretty strange, didn't you?
No. I know he was acting strange.
You started getting more and more and more worried the less and less Mr. King listened to you, correct?
Right. Yeah, one time I wanted to jump out the car, but I didn't want to do that. Because I didn't think I'd done something.
Well, you thought he was acting kind of crazy, didn't you?
Huh?
You thought he was acting crazy, didn't you?
Acting strange, yeah.
That observation.
So they then go forward and they call Melanie Singer, who was the state trooper who was first on the scene. She describes how they stopped King, she and her partner, and that he wised off to her. As he has his hands on the top of the car, he wiggles his fanny at her. She was then displaced by the Los Angeles police, who arrive on the scene and who took jurisdiction, with Sergeant Stacy Kuhn being the guy who was in charge of the LAPD crowd. Melanie Singer then describes what she sees and describes the beating using the nightstick, the kind of stick that they use as a weapon. And she's then cross-examined with some inconsistencies. Here it's just worth looking at the picture. These are the pictures of King. And he sustained numerous blows to his legs and so forth, and he had a cut. But there were some inconsistencies in her testimony. They then go to the testimony of the nurse. This is the first nurse at the place where King is taken after he's beaten, and they're introducing some statements by King about what happened to him.
Mr. King, we played a little ball tonight too, didn't we?
Powell was with him. Powell is there.
Mr. King replied, "I don't know," or "I don't know what you mean." And then Mr. Powell said, "We played a little hardball tonight. Do you remember who was playing?" And Mr. King said something to the effect, "I guess so." And Mr. Powell said, we won and you lost, or something to that effect.
My name's Lawrence Ernest Davis.
Nurse Lawrence Davis was also in the emergency room that night.
What did Officer Powell say?
Officer Powell says it's a good thing that I'm not going to the game. I wouldn't want you to be my usher.
And what did Mr. King say to that?
Nothing.
And did Officer Powell then say anything else?
Later on in the conversation, as I was doing my assessment, Officer Powell made a comment that he asked Rodney if he remembered that
he asked who?
Rodney King.
Okay, please refer to him by his proper name.
Mr. King. Okay. He asked Mr. King if he remembered the game that they played that night, referring to themselves, the police officers.
What exactly did he say?
He asked, did you see the game we played tonight?
And he was directed that comment toward Mr. King?
Yes, sir.
And what did Mr. King say?
Mr. King said, I don't recall, I don't know what you're talking about.
And what did Mr. Powell say to that?
He said, oh, come on, don't you remember? You know, we had a pretty good hardball game tonight.
And what did Mr. King say to that?
Mr. King just, he didn't realize what they were talking about.
Mr. King did not reply to that?
Not then, no.
And did Mr. Powell say something else?
Yeah, he says, yo, don't you remember in the hardball game, we hit quite a few home runs. And then Mr. King, it dawned on him who they were talking about. And Mr. King said, oh, yes, I remember. You guys did have a pretty good ball game tonight.
The prosecution introduces more so-called state-of-mind evidence against Lawrence Powell. Messages sent by Powell to a colleague on a mini-computer in his police car just after the incident.
What message was sent to 16823?
The message that was sent to 16823 was, oops, what?
Then at 1:13 and 53 seconds in the morning, Unit 16823 sent a message back to Unit 16FB9, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And what was that message?
The message states, I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time.
The state's strategy is to portray Powell as a person who knew what he had done, knew it was wrong, and didn't care. Next, an audio tape of Powell's radio call for an ambulance. Powell's reference to King's injuries as numerous head wounds and his laughter afterwards is introduced as evidence of Powell's inappropriate behavior. Now the prosecution turns to the state of mind of Sergeant Coon. A police car computer message was sent by Sergeant Coon to headquarters just after the incident.
The message that was sent to the ACC states, you, and that happens to be unit, just had a big time use of force, tased and beat the suspect of a CH pursuit big time.
Prosecutors argue that when Sergeant Coon stated that Rodney King was beat and tased in a big-time use of force, Coon was admitting that the use of force was excessive. Without addressing the state of mind of the other two defendants, the prosecution turns to a last important aspect of its case, the medical condition of Rodney King after the beating.
I'm going to skip over this. King actually doesn't testify. The crucial stuff comes with the prosecution.
Beating of Rodney King.
And you said that you observed him to be buffed out. Would you please describe to the jury what buffed out means to you? Buffed out is jargon that I've come to associate with very muscular. In other words, an individual that is very pumped up as far as muscles. And does that have some significance to you?
Yes, it does.
And what is that significance? The buffed out. Yes, Your Honor, with regard to your state of mind, what were you thinking when you saw this buffed out person?
My initial response is that he's probably an ex-con. The CHP officer, Melanie Senior, began approaching the suspect with a gun in hand.
And how close did she get to Mr. King?
I'd approximate about from your distance to the edge of the jury box there, about 5-6 feet.
And did you say anything to Officer Singer?
Yes, sir, I did.
And what was that?
I ordered her to stay back.
And why was that, sir?
because she was injecting a gun into the situation. And my tactical training had led me to believe that you don't approach suspects that have control with the gun.
Kuhn describes how officers tried but could not restrain King.
The next thing I saw is Officer Powell is thrown off of Mr. King, and Officer Brasino is struggling to get away.
All right, when you say thrown off, can you describe for the jury what you mean by thrown off, what position he was in?
Well, Mr. King's left arm was behind him, and Officer Powell was on his back. And Officer Brasino was trying to force the arm up to meet so that the wrist would match behind the cuff. And all of a sudden, Mr. King's arm just came out from him. And he swayed to the left, swayed to the right, and Officer Powell was thrown off, and Officer Brasino kind of landed on his behind. I ordered him to back off, and then I tased the suspect, Mr. King.
All right, did you say anything to him before you tased him?
Yes.
Taser is like a cattle prod. It's 50,000 volts. When you see the video, you'll see a little wire running between Kuhn and King. Kuhn has actually tased him twice in the course of this event, and that is what a taser is.
What did you say, Ben? He was on the rise, and I ordered him to get down, to lay down.
All right, tell the jury what you mean by on the rise, sir.
He had initially gone out flat, and after the rolling motion, he had kind of come up to his left side, and his torso was off the ground, and his legs were cocked, and he was attempting, in my opinion, to rise off the ground.
And did you say anything to him?
Yes, I told him. I ordered him to lay down, to get down.
And did you say this in a normal tone?
No, I shouted it at him. I advised him, or told him that if he didn't get down, I was going to tase him.
All right. And did he stay down?
No, he did not.
What did he do?
He continued to rise.
And what did you do?
I tased him.
Did you see any physical movements of Mr. King?
No, he grimaced. He kind of gave out like a bear-like yell.
And what did he do then?
He continued to rise. He got up to his knees, and he began to turn 180 degrees toward me.
And what happened then?
I ordered him again to lay down, to get down.
And what did he do?
He continued to rise. He came up, he continued to rise to his feet, and I tased him a second time.
And what did he do after you tased him the second time?
He repeated this groan, similar to like a wounded animal, and then I could see the vibrations on him, but he seemed to be overcoming it.
Sergeant Kuhn then establishes what will become a major theme, the officer's fear of Rodney King.
I thought that the suspect was under the influence of PCP. PCP is a dangerous drug. It's kind of like a policeman's nightmare, that the individual that's under this is super strong. They have more or less a one-track mind. They exhibit super strength, and they equate it with a monster, is what they equate it with.
While both the defense and the prosecution agreed in court that Rodney King was legally drunk, there was no evidence of PCP use. But Sergeant Kuhn says it's what he thought that matters.
You see the officers giving a torrent of blows to his body?
Yes, to his arms, to his torso, to his legs.
All right, have you given any specific direction to Mr. King at this time?
I've been yelling at him to get down, to stay down at this time.
All right, and has he gotten down, sir?
No, sir, he continues to rise.
And what are you thinking now, sir?
I'm getting concerned, scared. I'm getting a little frightened here now because this gentleman has just been subjected to a multitude of blows with the metal PR-24, and there is no evidence that he's going to go into compliance mode.
As Kuhn testifies, it becomes increasingly apparent that the defense is trying to use the tape for its own advantage.
Sergeant Kuhn, at this point in time, this incident has just gone on several seconds, is that correct?
It's gone on, it seems like an eternity, but it's gone on several seconds, yes.
All right, and Mr. King has been hit several times?
He's been hit a lot of times.
And at this point, do you believe he's trying to get up?
Yes, I do.
And what did you think he was trying to get up to do?
That he was going to get up and arm himself and possibly attack Officer Wynn here in the background, Officer Powell, Officer Brasino.
During this entire incident, do you believe that you were in charge of your officers?
Yes, I was in charge of my officers.
Do you believe that your officers did anything improper?
Overruled. You didn't ask the question.
No, this was a managed and controlled use of force. It followed the policies and procedures of Los Angeles Police Department and the training.
How do you view looking at this videotape, sir?
Overruled. You can ask the question.
It's violent and it's brutal.
Was this anything that you enjoyed?
No.
Why was it done?
It's done to control an aggressive combative suspect, and sometimes police work is brutal. It's just a fact of life.
Your Honor, I have no questions.
Mr. Stone?
I have no questions.
Mr. DePasquale?
No questions, Your Honor.
All right.
None of the other defense lawyers cross-examined Sergeant Kuhn, a show of apparent unity. But on cross-examination, Prosecutor Alan Yokelson tries to chip away at his testimony.
So you felt that you were responsible for directing the actions of all of the officers at the scene, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And therefore you would have responsibility for the actions of the officers at the scene, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And when you gave directions to the Los Angeles police officers there, you take responsibility for all of their actions, correct?
Yes, sir. I take accountability and responsibility for all the actions.
Those who were within the law and those who were without that are outside the law. Is that correct?
Objection sustained. Not of evidence.
It's argumentative. Objection sustained. When is deadly force authorized by Los Angeles Police Department?
I'm not sure what you mean by when it's authorized.
When can you shoot somebody under LAPD policy?
When they're an imminent threat to you.
What kind of threat?
Deadly threat to you. They have to pose a deadly threat to you.
In other words, they have to be in a position to kill you.
That's correct, sir.
And what was Mr. King doing here that led you to believe that he was going to kill you or kill somebody?
It was my belief and my perception. He was under the influence of PCP. If he had grabbed my officer, it would have been a death grip. If he had grabbed the weapon, he would have had numerous targets, sir.
He didn't grab anybody during these events, did he?
No, sir, he did not.
He didn't kick anybody during these events, did he?
No, sir, he did not.
Is it your testimony that you were approaching the point where deadly force was going to be required?
Yes, sir, it is.
And your option would have been to shoot him?
To choke or to shoot, sir.
But because of what you've just spoken about with respect to the chokehold, your only option left would have been to shoot him, is that right?
Yes, sir. I personally would have applied a chokehold to Mr. King prior to ordering him to be shot.
So you would have gone in and used his chokehold, is that right?
I would not have delegated that to any officer. I personally would have done that.
The questions turn to the baton blows.
Is it your testimony that every one of these blows depicted on this videotape is a justified use of force within the meaning of the policy of the Los Angeles Police Department?
I can't honestly say that I saw every one of those blows that was on the videotape.
In watching the videotape now, is it your testimony that every one of the blows that you see on there is a justified use of force?
It's a reasonable and necessary using the minimum force. Yes, sir, that is my testimony.
In all your years of experience, Sergeant, have you ever seen a worse beating applied by officers of Los Angeles Police Department?
I've seen uses of forces of considerable violence, but I have not seen anything as violent as this in my 14 and a half years. No, sir.
It appears that the prosecution has made little headway. Kuhn stands by the actions of the officers on duty that night.
Let me explain to you what it is that he's saying. This is an expert witness for the cops who's about to come in and go through it, and I'm not going to spend too much time with him. He says that his actions, the actions of his men, was consistent with the administrative regulations and the training of the Los Angeles Police Department. What was that? What they offer is a three-tiered structure, which applies when you're arresting a suspect. If the suspect you're arresting is compliant, you are not allowed to use any force. If the suspect you're arresting is non-compliant, you are allowed to use non-deadly force, which is defined as the use of the baton below the neck. If the person you're arresting is causing an imminent danger, you may use deadly force. And the way the training goes, the idea is that you watch a suspect. And as a suspect, the name of the game is to keep the suspect out of the highest category. So when you arrest a suspect who is compliant, you simply order them to put their hands in back of their back and accept the handcuffs, or lie down on the ground and put their hands in their back. When they're non-compliant but not deadly, you whack them with the baton, and you whack them hard in order to push them toward compliance. If you see the suspect moving towards compliance, you desist. But if you see the suspect getting up and going into non-compliance, you whack them to keep them down so that you don't go in to the deadly force. That was the structure that he's talking about as the structure within which the police were behaving and which the supervisors on the scene were instructing the police to behave. Now, I don't know, we may get blitzed for time, but I want to show you Powell, and then I want to show you the...
The Monster Coon's version of events, I'll just defense calls an expert.
One question
Charles
here.
Charles Errol Duke, Jr., D-U-K-E.
Duke, a veteran of more than 20 years with the Los Angeles Police Department, helps establish a key defense strategy to turn the videotape to its own advantage. Duke meticulously dissects the tape, identifying the blows and kicks as direct reactions to aggressive movements by Rodney King.
What did Mr. King do based upon your perception?
Mr. King came from a... outstretched, prone position.
Here, and I'm going to go through until we get to the cross here, I hope. And just show you the beginning of that. And then go to Powell. You see what he does, what he's doing fast forward here, is he's going through frame by frame and showing the officers escalating up and down in response to what King is doing. And he does that meticulously through the different frames of the videotape. Oh, here we go.
I wasn't shocked.
Now, wait a minute. I gotta go back. I gotta get you this. Okay, here we go.
You tend to be attempting to rise. Would it be appropriate within the policy and procedure to strike the...
Terry White asks him a question and starts with the typical never ask question.
Sergeant Duke, when you first saw this videotape, you were shocked by what you saw, weren't you?
I wasn't shocked, no.
When you first saw this videotape, did you believe that it possibly contained excessive force by these officers?
I never form an opinion until I get all the facts.
Sergeant Duke, when you first looked at this videotape, did you possibly believe that it contained excessive force? Yes or no?
I'd have to say no.
White turns to the...
So that turns out to be a fruitless cross-examination. All right, so we will through, and I want to get you to Powell. And then the film. This, by the way, is being tried in California to an all-white jury as the result of a change of venue from Los Angeles to Alameda County.
Anticipated one to take the stand in this trial.
Lawrence Michael Powell.
Lawrence Powell has the most to explain. He is seen hitting Rodney King over 45 times. Powell testifies about when he and his partner, defendant Timothy Wynn, joined in the chase after Rodney King's car.
I looked in to see how many occupants there were, could count three, and saw the driver and the passenger looking back at us at one point.
When you say looking back, were they continuously looking back?
at different times. It wasn't all three turned their heads at the same time, but the passenger looked back. I saw the driver look back at a time. I saw the passenger look back another time, and the driver, all their heads were going like little dolls. That indicated to me that they knew we were there, and that the police were behind them with lights and siren going.
Powell testifies about the first moments when he saw King.
I saw the blank stare, the slow, stiff movements, and he wasn't complying with the verbal commands, and I could see sweat glistening on his face.
Did his conduct concern, did his conduct figure into your evaluation?
Yes, it did.
And in what way?
And I was scared that this guy was under PCP.
In your mind, was it safe to approach him at that point?
No.
Why did you approach him?
Sergeant Kuhn told me to. I walked up to the left side of Mr. King and reached down and grabbed his left wrist and placed my right hand just behind his neck on his back and tried to pull the arm out from underneath him.
What was your reason for doing that?
I wanted him to be laying on the ground so I could handcuff him. Mr. King took his arms and broke them free of my grasp and the other officer's grasp, put him down on the ground in a push-up position, raised up his torso, and knocked me off, and I fell backwards and landed on my rear.
When this happened, did that concern you?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I had all my body weight on top of this guy, and in a matter of a second, he had done a push-up and had knocked me off and wasn't complying with the handcuffing. He was resisting. His biting.
As you were struggling or tugging on his arms, were you assessing anything?
Yes, he did great strength and resistance in his arms.
You could feel that?
I could feel it, and I could see. He had very powerful arms. This was a big man.
Was there ever a time when you stood facing Mr. King, both of you on your feet, where he is flailing his arms and you're swinging a baton in a forward and reverse power stroke at his shoulders?
No.
Was there ever a time when you were in those same relative positions and you swung your baton in forward and reverse power strokes and struck Mr. King in the jaw or face?
No.
Tell the jury what you remember about that charge.
Just remember, just real fast, I had no time to react. It was practically a head-on collision where I had to step aside, and I had my baton out, but I wasn't able to swing it and
all
get
right,
in a swing.
Let's stop there now. When you say it was almost a head-on collision, describe to the jury in more detail which direction Mr. King was coming toward you, if that was the case, and how you were facing him, if you were.
Yes, he was coming straight towards me, and I was facing directly at him.
All right. And what was the position of his arms?
His arms were up in a manner like this, about shoulder height, with his hands out.
You described his arms extending out from his body, his hands open.
Right.
And as he came toward you, was he moving slowly or fast?
Very quickly.
And tell the jury what you did in response to that.
I didn't have time to react. I was starting to swing, but it was more like a checked swing when he collided into me.
Right, after the collision, and did Mr. King continue to go in the direction that he was going?
Yes.
And were you able to watch him?
Yes.
And just describe what you saw.
It was his, like a ragdoll, no muscles, just everything quit, and his face just went in a straight crashing position and landed on his face.
What did you see next?
I saw his head bounce back up, and then his arms came in underneath him, and he went into a push-up position again, raising his torso off the ground, and bringing his legs in. And
what did you do then?
I hit him with the power stroke on his right arm and yelled at him to get down on the ground.
Right. Now, why did you...
I'm going to just keep going forward because we're running out of time, and I want to get to the cross.
He basically just describes following orders, being scared, each of the movements.
And has reinforced the same story Sergeant Stacy Coon told from the stand, that the force used was justified. But on cross-examination, Prosecutor Terry White focuses on Powell's possible motivation.
When you type something into the MBT, do you think about it before you type it?
Usually, yes.
All right. Usually, you think about what you want to type, and then you type the word in. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Your fingers just don't go over that keyboard or the typing board involuntarily, do they?
No.
Your mind works before your fingers start working. Is that correct?
Yes.
White asks about a police computer message Powell sent just before the incident.
You replied to her. Sounds almost as exciting as our last call. It was right out of Gorillas in the Mist. And that's what you typed into her, isn't it?
Yes.
And she typed back, ha 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 ha. Let me guess who be the parties. You remember that, don't you?
Yes.
And then you typed in a message to her about trying to get through the night and that you were off for 6 days and it was time for some serious bike riding. And then you typed in, good guess, didn't you?
I believe so.
Now this incident that you're referring to, this last call right out of Gorillas in the Mist, it involved a family of African Americans, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And in your description of these individuals, you called them gorillas, didn't you?
No. Okay.
Now this call that involved these African Americans, was it in a jungle?
In a what?
A jungle.
No.
Was it at the zoo?
No.
Were there any gorillas around?
I didn't see any.
This is the movie Gorillas in the Mist, is that correct?
Yes.
Was there any wildlife around at all during this call?
Not that I saw.
Other than just these individuals who were African Americans, is that correct?
No, I wouldn't call them wildlife.
But you referred to that call as right out of Gorillas in the Mist.
Yes.
There were no gorillas there, were there?
No, I didn't see any.
Was that movie playing on their TV when you were there?
I didn't go inside the house.
Did you see anything regarding Gorillas in the Mist while you were at that location?
Did I see anything?
Yes.
No.
Again trying to discredit Powell, the prosecutor turns to the computer message sent after the incident.
Officer Powell, you used excessive force when you beat Rodney King, didn't you?
No, sir.
Officer Powell, you used inappropriate conduct in that incident with Rodney King, didn't you?
No, sir.
Why did you tell Karina Smith, I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time? Why did you use the word beaten?
That's a common police jargon. When you talk to the police, it's kind of a professional jargon.
Professional jargon? So you go up to someone and say, how many people did you beat today?
I don't do that, no.
But you did it here.
No, I didn't do that.
Well, you used the word beaten.
Yes, I did use the word beaten.
Well, beat and beaten, the same thing, isn't it?
What do you mean, the same thing?
Same word.
Form of the same word, sure.
And that's professional police jargon in your mind?
No, it's jargon used in the police profession.
At any time during this evening, did it go through your mind that this was not a human being that you were beating?
I'm going to just carry you forward. Now, I want you to take a look at the videotape one more time. And I want to set it first for you in context. Beck, would you come over and keep your... Well, actually, I can do it. First, understand that this videotape doesn't start until the incident
is quite far along. He's already been tased twice. At the beginning of this video is the crucial part. The part that's out of focus comes after he's been tased twice. He charges the officer. He literally knocks him down, this thing that Kuhn is talking about. And it's after that that the videotape picks up. So as it goes forward, see if you can hear the get downs. See if you can see the officers acting in response. See if you can see it from their point of view. Just see if you can.
The full videotape, not just the short snippets aired on the news, is played in court.
Watch the right there. He gets up and charges the cop. Bang. That's right at the beginning.
The full videotape, not just the short snippets aired on the news, is played in court.
One more time. See the charge.
He was awakened by police sirens and helicopters, and he took out his new video camera to shoot the event. The full videotape, not just the short snippets aired on the news, is played in court. Parts of it, such as when King rushes at the officers, are blurred.
Now they hold him back. There he is. Now he's getting up, and they whack him. They're yelling at him, get down, get down. They want him lying on the ground, they want his hands in back of him. See how many officers are standing around? This is like a supervised thing. They say they don't want too many officers engaging him at once because they just get in each other's way. But Kuhn actually thought that this was an effective demonstration. When he first heard about the videotape, he said, we'll use it in trainings. They're telling him, put his hands in back. Get down, get down. All right. So there's a part in there that becomes, they're acquitted here. There's a federal prosecution that follows. They are convicted. Kuhn and Powell are convicted in the federal prosecution. It's something we can talk about. But the important thing that I wanted to communicate to you was this feeling of being able to shift a stance. And what I'm looking for is for you to practice that. I'd like to give you an assignment. I'd like you to watch The Battle of Algiers. It's a great movie. It's a film that takes the issue of terror and has you see it from another point of view. Now, one of the things that we needed to do today that I didn't... There are two things we needed to do that I didn't get to. Sorry? Still, I'll be right here. One is the pass-fail project. If I understand it right, the Pass-Fail Project has an appointment to see the dean tomorrow. And up on the wiki, there is a proposal which suffers as it stands from the fact that it doesn't see the other side of the argument. I invite you, all of those concerned, not just those who want to go for it, to look at the wiki and help out, build out the arguments against. Not so much the arguments for, the arguments against. Second, we need to form groups, but I can't do that today. We're going to have to do that first thing tomorrow. Sorry, I kept you over.